says it has intercepted several Israeli missiles fired towards Damascus countryside. The Yemeni army takes control of more areas in Ma'arib in its push to liberate the oil-rich province from Saudi-backed militants. Also in the headlines, the Arab League says it is concerned about the deterioration of ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon following a Lebanese minister's remarks about the war in Yemen. Thanks for joining us. Syria says its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles, targeted sites and countryside around the capital, Damascus, and downed some of them. Our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, tells us more about the attack.
It has been confirmed that it was an Israeli attack that hit Damascus countryside at 11:17 a.m. Local time, according to an official military source. Israel launched an attack using surface-to-surface, ground-to-ground missiles, firing them from the northern parts of the occupied Palestinian territories on Damascus countryside. According to the official military source, Syria's air defenses were able to intercept the enemy missiles, shoot down some of them. However, other missiles seem to have hit their targets, and the attack led to the injury of two Syrian army soldiers and also caused some material damage.
The Yemeni army has made further advances in Ma'arib province, taking control of a military camp near the provincial capital. Yemeni forces captured the Rish camp after fierce clashes with Saudi-backed militants. The camp is located in the Juba district south of Ma'arib province. The Yemeni army also gained control over the Jarsha district. These are the latest in a series of gains that the Yemeni army has made in recent days. Since last year, Ma'arib has turned into a focus of the Yemeni army operations. It is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces. The Arab League has expressed deep concerns about the worsening of ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon. The Secretary General of the organization has urged those nations to avoid further measures that will negatively affect the ailing Lebanese economy. Ahmed Al-Fayt has also called on Lebanese leaders to act quickly to ease the diplomatic crisis. Criticism by the Lebanese Information Minister of Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen has triggered angry reactions from the kingdom and its allies. Riyadh has summoned its ambassador to Beirut and expelled the Lebanese envoy. It has also banned all Lebanese imports. In a recent interview, the Lebanese minister branded the Saudi-led war in Yemen as futile and demanded an end to it. Anti-French sentiment is running high in Mali, where thousands have come out to protest for a military presence in the West African country. The demonstrators have flooded the streets of the capital, Bamako, waving national flags and chanting slogans against France. Some of them set fire to the French flag. They are angry with French interference in Mali's political affairs. They also want a total withdrawal of French troops from the country.
We are here for Mali. We are here to demonstrate our national sovereignty, to remind the whole world that sovereignty belongs to the people, and that today those who have not understood this must update themselves.
France, which is Mali's former colonial ruler, has over 5,000 troops there to help fight the resurgence of extremist groups. But many in Mali consider the mission a failure. Paris now plans to reduce the number of its military personnel in Mali to 3,000. The UN Special Representative in Sudan has urged the country's paramilitary forces to avoid confrontation during anti-coup protests scheduled for Saturday. The UN envoy made the call during a meeting with Rapid Support Force Chief Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. The capital, Khartoum, is bracing for major demonstrations on Saturday, following deadly clashes between security forces and protesters. At least 8 people have been killed and 170 others injured over the past days. Paramilitary and army forces have been deployed across Khartoum, as well as the twin cities of Khartoum North and Omdurman. the Sudanese military staged a coup on Monday and declared a state of emergency. The move has drawn international condemnation. Political commentator Julius Paluto says that the Sudanese people are fed up with military coups in their country and want a democratic government.
Just like a Sudanese citizen, I can sense the undercurrent of politics there, whereby a lot of people, Sudanese, are yearning for change, and that change means democratic rule. Remember, Sudan has been there. 17 coups have been there in the country, some successful, others not. But it's time since independence of Sudan. It's about time when I think people think they've had enough of military coups. They just don't want it anymore. And I can see tomorrow a lot of determination on the streets of Sudan by the protesters. We are seeing right now a lot of protesters who led the revolution, which was hijacked by the military. Before, of course, the discussions, agreement for transitional government happened. We are seeing them coming back. Iconic figures, even ladies who are leading that revolution, are already, some of them are back, and definitely there will be change, because I see a situation whereby the Sudanese are not relenting. They will never stop until they get civilian leadership, democratic rule, because that's what they deserve.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Leaders of the world's most advanced nations begin the G20 summit in the Italian capital, Rome. Climate change, health, and the relaunch of the global economy tops the agenda of the two-day talks. Participants are under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. The event comes amid protests at no inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, has also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment. Max Chibidi is our correspondent from Rome who joins us, and we also have John Stepling, an author and commentator, to give us a breakdown on this. So Max, at this point, we know the leaders are arriving. Tell us about that, and also any news on the protests there.
Well, the first in-person summit since the coronavirus pandemic has begun under maximum security, with a 10 square kilometer red zone around the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. Authorities have stepped up security big time in the city, in Rome. Between 5,000 and 6,000 police officers, along with 500 soldiers, have been deployed to ensure security. And large parts of the Eur, the district surrounding the Congress Center that is hosting the summit, have been cordoned off from yesterday. And no one will be allowed to enter without special permission. Also, airspace is closed over Rome, and border controls enhanced to try to keep away violent foreign demonstrators and masked rioters such as the Black Bloc. Yesterday I was at a protest, an anti-G20 protest, and one of the protesters said to me that holding this G20 summit in big cities is like a sort of a social provocation. He said to me, why don't they organize it on an aircraft carrier or in a small town at the top of the mountain?
John Stepling, when you take a look at these protests in particular, some of the things that are being said are things, or that are being protested against, are things that have plagued the world, so to speak, for quite some time. Not just climate change, and of course in the age of the pandemic, we're looking at something that's rather a new phenomenon. Do you think the world countries, how would you evaluate them in terms of how they have tackled things like injustice, inequality, etc.?
I think the first thing when you look at these gatherings, G20 or the Davos or any of these global gatherings of world leaders and the heads of NGOs and just celebrity billionaires of one sort or another, is to remember that this has nothing to do with a democratic process to change the gross inequality we see globally. If one, just to take the topic of climate change, there's never a mention of militarism. There's never a mention of U.S. militarism. A massive consumer of petroleum products, a polluter wherever you find a U.S. base, you will find pollution. A majority of Superfund sites in the U.S. are former U.S. military bases, for example. But this topic is never discussed. It's never even broached. And when you look at who is invited in terms of world leaders, I mean, it's like the who's who from the Book of Fascism. I mean, you have Bolsonaro and Trudeau and Macron and these people. You don't see anybody invited from third world countries except for client states. War criminals like Paul Kagame get invited, but Maduro in Venezuela is not invited. Nobody representing Bolivia is invited. Certainly nobody from North Korea. I didn't see anybody from Iran invited. But it's a spectacle. It's political theater, and these people are not interested in solving inequality. They are interested in cornering the emerging markets in rare earth minerals and things like that, and in social control. We have to understand that this is taking place against the backdrop of the tail end of the COVID pandemic, although you wouldn't know it from Canada and Australia, in which you had unprecedented social control restrictions imposed on entire populations. And when Oxfam, another one of these corrupted NGOs out there, is arguing about, oh, well, the third world needs access to vaccines. No, they need money and clean water and to be left alone to rebuild their societies. That's what they need. So the entire thing is political theater on some level, and it's insidious. And as I say, the real subject is going to be the fourth industrial revolution. Moving forward, increased surveillance, digitalization, cashless society, all of which furthers the control imposed by this consolidation of wealth that we have seen over the last 15, 20 years. Unprecedented. And, the Bill Gates and Bezos and Musk and Mark Benioff and all of these people that wield incredible power, unelected billionaires who wield incredible power, and they're hugely influential in these gatherings, and it is their agenda largely that is going to be unrolled here, I fear.
Okay, Max Willey, quickly if we can, we know this is a two-day conference. Tell us a little bit about the agenda of the talks, and then what issues really stand out that we hopefully may get some answers to in terms of how they're going to go about it.
Top of the agenda is the pandemic and how to deal with its consequences. And then the G20 leaders are also expected to discuss efforts to speed up the global economic recovery, addressing soaring energy prices and the supply chains snarl. Also, I didn't mention before that there will be protests against the G20 organized in the afternoon. In about 1 hour, two protests will begin here in Rome, a sit-in against the Italian Prime Minister Draghi government and the government of the bankers. During the G20 days is set to start soon in San Giovanni Square, and another march including climate initiative, Fridays for Future, and trade unions will take place shortly afterwards. Tens of thousands of participants are expected to join, and the authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists may pose if they infiltrate the protests.
Okay, thank you for that. That's Max Civilli, a correspondent from Rome. John Stepling, a pleasure, author and commentator there, talking to us from Indoor. With that, we come to an end for this news review. government has appealed a court ruling on individual welfare compensation to indigenous children. Ottawa says it is instead working to strike a deal with indigenous groups by the end of the year. The government says that it is putting the appeal on hold to start 2 months of talks from next week to negotiate a deal. Indigenous communities stress that they would not leave out the issue of children's legal liabilities in the negotiations. The initial ruling required the Canadian government to pay billions of dollars to more than 55,000 Indigenous children. Ottawa appealed the ruling on Friday after a series of victories for Indigenous people in years-long legal battles. Indigenous Canadian communities are still reeling from recent discoveries of hundreds of unmarked graves of children at residential schools. International lawyer Barry Grossman says the Canadian government should make arrangements to compensate the Indigenous children instead of looking for ways to delay the payments.
The time to reach a negotiated resolution is before one party compels the other to make its case in court, and after a long, tedious, and expensive process, get a judgment. Frankly, I consider it a confirmation of the paternal attitude taken by the Canadian federal government towards Indigenous peoples. Something like $40,000 Canadian dollars was awarded to each of the affected children. They simply should make arrangements to pay it. I can't think of any reason why they would want to delay that. And excuse me. Let's be clear. The federal government in Canada says that it's willing to accept the judgment, that is to accept liability, but wants to negotiate the manner in which the money's paid because, in its opinion, it's inappropriate to have a sort of one-size-fits-all mentality. And while intuitively that makes some sense in the sense that some people were no doubt more seriously affected than others, I doubt that that's what is motivating the federal government to take its position. Frankly, if that was an appropriate position to take, it could easily have been argued in court and the judgment structured around that.
And that is it for this edition of World News. It's well out for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Americans lose their lives due to violence and shooting. Estimates show that more than 90% of crimes is committed by men. Crimes from mass shooting to murder, armed robbery, and rape. But what is the reason behind this overwhelming amount of violence in American society? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Perhaps to understand the culture of violent masculinity in America, one must look into the myth that being a real man means putting up a false front and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Stay with us as in this episode of Aperture, Tough Guys provides a stunning look at the violence boys and young men routinely receive from virtually every corner of the American culture. From television, movies, video games, advertising, the sports culture, and U.S. political culture. Don't go away.
Deadliest mass shooting in American history.
You were just joining us. Two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats opened fire at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
When it comes to violence, it's almost like there are two Americas.
It's horrific. You can't put it into words.
There's the America that recoils in horror whenever a brutal mass shooting erupts onto our television screens, shocked by the level of destruction and suffering that just a few individuals are capable of visiting upon so many innocent people.
Police say that the gunman opened fire in a theater during a showing of that latest Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises.
And then there's the America that can't seem to get enough of violence as a form of entertainment and ritual, a seemingly endless appetite for ever-intensifying spectacles of all-out brutality and carnage. The question is what sort of relationship, if any, these two Americas have to one another. And if we're serious about answering that question, we need to stop chasing symptoms and take a good look at a truth that's been hiding in plain sight all along. That when we talk about violence in America, whether it's real or imaginary, we're almost always talking about violent masculinity. I'm Jackson Katz, and for more than 25 years, I've worked on both a personal and an institutional level to engage men directly in the effort to prevent men's violence against women and children. The reason I work with and focus on men is simple, because for the most part, violence is a men's issue. The statistics tell the story. 86% of armed robberies are committed by men. 77% of aggravated assaults are committed by men. 87% of stalkers are men. 86% of domestic violence incidents resulting in physical injury are perpetrated by men. 99% of rapes are committed by men. Men commit approximately 90% of murder. And over the past 30 years, 61 of the last 62 mass shootings have been committed by men. But while these numbers are striking, they rarely, if ever, come into play in mainstream discussions about violence.
After every event like this, the questions always are the same. What causes this kind of a shooting? How can this happen? How can they be stopped?
During hours and hours of exhaustive reporting, commentators seem to go out of their way to find gender-neutral ways to talk about this violence.
The shooters in Aurora, the shooters in Newtown,
the Connecticut shooter,
the Aurora shooter,
the alleged shooter, teenage psychopath,
mass murderers,
the suspect,
that kid,
this punk,
this murderer.
The male perpetrators become shooters or murderers or assailants or killers or suspects or psychopaths.
It's kids killing kids in the heart of America.
Violence committed by boys becomes kids killing kids and youth violence.
Here is a revealing and frankly horrifying picture of youth violence in America.
It doesn't seem to matter that girls are kids and youths too, but only commit a fraction of these kinds of crimes. And this baseline failure to acknowledge gender has a big effect when the discussion turns to other supposed causes of violence.
Violence in the entertainment culture.
Bloody games, gory movies, brutal TV shows.
Call of Duty or Halo.
Mental health issues, the faith issues.
Autism or Asperger's syndrome.
You're blaming the gun.
Their mom and their dad.
Substance abuse.
Mental health, violent games, violent movies.
I want to blame the real culprit.
Alex.
Suicide pills.
Alex.
Mass murder pills.
We hear very little, if anything, about why it is that girls and women also live in a culture saturated with guns and media violence, also suffer from mental illness, also come from dysfunctional families and have substance abuse problems, yet don't commit anywhere near the amount of violence boys and men do. In other cases, the perpetrators disappear altogether.
together.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
You see this a lot in the mainstream discussion about so-called violence against women. The fact that men are responsible for somewhere around 98% of this violence simply evaporates. We hear about women being harassed, abused, assaulted, or raped. Men are nowhere to be found. And the result of all this is that instead of seeing men's violence against women as a men's issue, we see it as a women's issue and focus most of our attention on how to help victims and survivors after the fact. A failure all the more glaring given that mainstream media outlets have no problem at all taking gender seriously when women are the ones doing the violence.
Teenage girls involved in violent fights.
A fight between two young girls breaks out on the playground.
More and more teenage girls are getting involved in violent fights.
When girls and women act out violently, their gender becomes the story. The same way race becomes the story with men of color.
The horrific murder rate in Chicago. Does it have to do with guns or race?
When men of color rape women or shoot people or blow things up, race and culture move to the forefront of the story, crowding out the fact that the vast majority of the perpetrators under consideration, no matter what color they are men. All this is partly a function of how dominant ideologies work linguistically to conceal the power of dominant groups. For example, when we hear the word race in the United States, we tend immediately to think about African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, South Asians. And when we hear the term gender, we tend to think of women. In each case, the dominant group, white people, men, don't get examined, as if white people don't belong to some racial grouping, as if men don't have a gender. In other words, we always focus on the subordinated group and not on the dominant one. And that's one of the ways that the power of dominant groups isn't questioned, by remaining invisible.
There are young men involved in these things. There's a lot of testosterone there.
And on those rare occasions when the subject of men does make its way into mainstream discussions about violence, there's this common refrain that men's violence is all about testosterone and our prehistoric role as hunter-warriors were just programmed to be violent.
What is it about the testosterone of being a young man that makes this come to this gun violence head so often?
Why does it seem that these mass shooters are boys and not girls?
Really, it goes back to hunter-gatherer days.
Yeah. You hear another version of this in the common refrain, boys will be boys.
Let boys be boys. They want to play rough. Don't try and over-medicate them and, you know, turn them into girls. They're boys.
No one would deny that there are biological factors that sometimes come into play with violence. The problem is when biological arguments lead people to conclude that men are just beasts who are overcome by hormonal urges they can't control, that men are incapable of making moral and ethical decisions, that boys are born hardwired to bully, rape, and murder. But perhaps the most damaging thing this kind of thinking does is that it blinds us to the fundamental role that cultural systems play in all of this.
This is a document signed by six of the major public health organizations saying that the violence in the entertainment, the level that we've attained to today, is causing increased aggressive behavior among some children.
For decades, experts and government officials have been arguing that we need to take a closer look at the relationship between violence in the culture and violence in the real world.
And in the days since the heartbreaking tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, I also tasked the Vice President with leading an effort to come up with a comprehensive set of serious proposals to keep our children safe, including strengthening school safety, improving mental health care, and addressing a culture that too often glorifies guns and violence.
This focus on the culture of violence in America took on new and bipartisan urgency in the wake of Adam Lanza's cold-blooded murder of 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. But unfortunately, it quickly descended into a distracting and false debate between defenders of the gun industry and defenders of the entertainment industry.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people through vicious, violent video games.
On one side, you've had the gun industry blaming movies and video games.
We have blood-soaked films out there, like American Psycho, Natural Born Killers, that are aired like propaganda loops on splatter days and every single day.
On the other side of the debate, we've had the entertainment industry blaming the NRA and guns.
Can we not do a better job on controlling the weapons of violence that get to the wrong hands?
What both sides have failed to mention is how for years they've been mutually reinforcing parts of the same culture of violence and have profited handsomely from one another. And the reason this matters so much is that while we've been debating whether guns or movies and video games are more to blame for violence, we've missed what the culture teaches boys about what it means to be a man. We often talk about violence being a learned behavior, but it's more to the point to say that it's a taught behavior. And by shifting the focus from learned to taught, we
shift the onus of responsibility onto those of us who are teaching our sons what it means to be a man. Since the 1970s, sociologists and other researchers have identified a consistent set of messages the culture sends boys about what it means to be a real man. William Pollack introduced the idea of a boy code in which boys are taught from a very early age to act tough and not show their feelings. Michael Kimmel extended the reach of the boy code into late adolescence and young adulthood, where he describes a guy code in which young men police each other into conformity with dictates about manhood that come with an implicit and sometimes explicit warning. Don't slip up or you risk being unmasked and found out as someone who doesn't measure up. The result is that guys are put into a box that turns out to be the perfect breeding ground for violence. We can't show any emotion except anger. We can't think too much or seem too intellectual. We can't back down when someone disrespects us. We have to show we're tough enough to inflict physical pain and take it in turn. We're supposed to be sexually aggressive with women. Anything short of full-scale emotional shutdown becomes a source of humiliation and shame. And in response, young men learn to adopt what I call the tough guys, the front so many young men put up to shield their vulnerabilities and avoid being ridiculed. But it doesn't just come from their peer groups. It comes from fathers, coaches, and older male role models as well. Eastwood's character, like so many fathers, father figures, coaches, and other men in boys' lives, assumes the role of the director and proceeds to evaluate how well the young man performs his role. It doesn't matter how unnatural, complicated, or ridiculous the role is, boys are expected to learn their lines and master the tough guys, or else risk being shamed as less than a man. A pair of animated films show very clearly how this process is passed down intergenerationally.
Lenny, you see something, you kill it, you eat it, period. Thanks. That's what sharks do. That's a fine tradition. What's the matter with you?
Right here in front of me now, eat this.
In Shark Tale, the father shark makes it clear to his son, who is a vegetarian, that he has no choice but to conform to shark norms and become carnivorous and aggressive.
Frankie, I want you to take Lenny out, show him the ropes.
Oh, come on, Pop.
Son, you're going to learn how to be a shark, whether you like it or not.
I'm going to kill you, dragon.
Similarly, in How to Train Your Dragon, the son of a Viking leader runs into problems when he refuses to act violently. And the unwillingness of the boy to use violence causes a crisis in his relationship with his warrior father.
I don't want to fight dragons.
Yes, you do.
Who can't even comprehend that his son might not want to follow in his violent footsteps. Qualities like compassion, caring, empathy, intellectual curiosity, fear, vulnerability, even love. Basic human qualities that boys have inside them every bit as much as girls do. Get methodically driven out of them by a sexist culture that labels these things unmanly, feminine, womanly, and teaches boys to avoid them at all costs. And, most importantly, they're taught that real men turn to violence not as a last resort, but as the go-to method of resolving disputes, and also as the primary means of winning respect and establishing masculine credibility.
Good morning. This is Randy Pion on KRES Radio, the voice of the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation.
Film Smoke Signals, one of the first features produced by Native Americans, there's a memorable scene where an older kid tries to teach a younger kid how to be a real-life Hollywood Indian. The scene is funny, but it also shows how the pressure to conform to ideals of violent masculinity cuts across racial, ethnic, and class lines. As the sociologist Richard Majors has pointed out, African American and other men of color in urban areas often adopt a hyper-masculine, menacing persona he calls the cool pose to signal that they're still men, regardless of what else has been stripped from them. This is also true with Latino men,
checkmate, boo-boo,
who are disproportionately portrayed in Hollywood as gangbangers, Mexican drug lords, and thugs in the barrio, images that are crude stereotypes, but which nonetheless have become symbols of toughness to some poor and working-class Latinos whose manhood has been undermined by class exploitation and ethnic discrimination. And we see the same thing when it comes to Asian masculinity. In popular culture, Asian men have long been emasculated, stereotyped as ineffectual, desexualized, and unmanly. But since the early 1970s, running counter to this long line of neutered stereotypes is the highly stylized physicality and violence of the martial arts. But young Asian American men don't just have to look to Bruce Lee for cues. Increasingly, we've seen the phenomenon of Asian guys adopting the tough guy street styles of African American and Latino men to establish their masculine credentials. Middle-class white boys may not have a lot of experience with the kind of real-world inner-city conditions that gave rise to the cool pose, but the culture tells them if they take on this black, urban, hard-guy pose, they'll somehow be more real, more of a man. What makes this even more interesting is that a lot of the very guys they see as models of authenticity are themselves projecting an image they picked up from the culture. As the writer Nathan McCall has said, he and some of his African-American male cohorts got some of their ideas of manhood from The Godfather and other gangster films that featured tough, ruthless, white Italian gangsters. And the same kind of thing about Scarface.
It's one of the hottest movies ever made.
This is the all-time greatest movie.
Never seen nothing like that.
I watched this movie 63 times.
So we have this interesting phenomenon where we have white middle-class males emulating poor urban black males who in turn are getting part of their idea about manhood from gangster films featuring white men who are playing Italian and Cuban-American gangsters.
Now are we made or are we made, man?
The paradox is that the test of being real somehow comes down to how well you live up to a made-up script. And it's a script that's only become increasingly violent over time. Ideal of the real man owes a lot to the Hollywood Western and the ultimate icon of white American masculinity, John Wayne.
Young fella, if you're looking for trouble, I'll accommodate you.
While other men talked a lot, thought too much, equivocated, and showed emotion, John Wayne made the world bend to his will with just a stare, a few words, his fists, and his guns.
I haven't lost my temper in 40 years, but Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed, and somebody ought to belt you in the mouth. But I won't.
And then there's Hollywood gangster films with cinematic tough guys like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart.
One move out of you, son, I'll fill your pants full of lead. Get over there.
Men hardened by the world who knew the power of a few clipped words and a few rounds of ammunition. And this equation between toughness, manhood, and violence has continued and in many ways intensified over time. There's no question that over the past few decades, there's been a ratcheting up of what it takes to be considered a real man. Our action heroes. In the 1950s, Superman was the equivalent of an ordinary guy running around in tights and a cape. And today, he's pumped up and ripped. Well, Batman, the body of Adam West as Batman in the 1960s, is a far cry from the far more imposing Dark Knight of the 21st century. Pro wrestlers' bodies in the 1960s were more flabby. In the 21st century, they're way more sculpted, pumped up, and ripped. And look at toy action figures. If you look at the Star Wars toy figurines that kids played with in the 1970s and contrast them with the Star Wars toy figurines that are being marketed to kids today, you see a dramatic shift. Well, the body of G.I. Joe. A study done in the late 1990s found that over the past 50 years, the size of G.I. Joe's biceps in real-life equivalents increased from 12.2 inches in 1964 to 15.2 inches in 1974 to 16.4 inches in 1994 and up to 26.8 inches by 1998. If you wanted a comparison to a real person, the biceps of someone like The Rock are reportedly only about 20 inches. We can see a similar pattern in the changing level of violence itself over time. We've gone from pistols in the 1940s to larger weaponry in the 1970s to the increasing militarization of these weapons in the 80s and 90s to the larger-than-life heavy metal killing machines we have today. We've seen video game violence go from the benign aggressions of Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and Asteroids to the unimaginable and hyper-realistic bloodbaths of today's game. From the comparatively orderly sport of boxing to today's number one fighting sport, the street fighting viciousness of mixed martial arts and cage fighting. Now, there's no doubt we're in the throes of some kind of a crisis in masculinity. But rather than questioning whether it's our inability to move beyond the straitjacket of traditional masculinity that might be the source of this crisis, across the cultural and political landscape, there's been a growing movement to reclaim and reassert traditional manhood.
We need to toughen up and stand up for ourselves and learn to be a lot tougher than yoga is going to teach us to do all by ourselves.
The basic idea is that men are in crisis because women have been waging a full-scale war on traditional manhood.
We've been so emasculated by a so-called women's movement at this point. Even our strongest men are acting girly.
The whole culture is being feminized, in my opinion.
There's a certain emasculation that's happening in our culture.
Part of the problem is we've sort of feminized schools.
I think she's right. It's 100%. We're wussifying America.
Is this the wussification of America?
Yes, this is one more step in the wussification of America.
Is this the latest in the wussification of America?
The result is a narrative that tells men that the best way to respond to change is not to adapt, but to reclaim traditional masculine control and dominance from the forces of feminization.
The founding fathers were men, not wussies. It's the wussification of America that's killing us.
And as it turns out, this is an old pattern in American history. Take the
Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouting is one of the few institutions to balance the rather softening effect of our modern way of life.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, today, in this episode, I'm going to discuss domestic violence, and of course, domestic violence is a very live phenomenon which we need to deal with from different angles and from different perspectives. Domestic violence is a reality, it's undeniable, and it is a bitter reality, of course. What do we need to do in order to reduce domestic violence? We know that domestic violence cannot be eliminated under any circumstances, but it can be ameliorated, it can be reduced, and it can be somehow abated. But before we talk about domestic violence in further detail, I would like you to know a definition. Of course, we need to start with a definition. According to the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition, domestic violence is the inflicting of physical injury by one family or household member on another. And it's also a repeated or habitual pattern of such behavior. So a repeated and a habitual pattern of violence in the family atmosphere, in the family setting, is also considered to be domestic violence. In 1993, the United Nations Declaration on the Elimination of Violence Against Women defined domestic violence as such: physical, sexual, and psychological violence occurring in the family, including battering, sexual abuse of female children in the household, dowry-related violence, marital rape, and female genital mutilation, and other traditional practices harmful to women, non-spousal violence, and violence related to exploitation. So this is a definition offered by the United Nations, of course, in 1993. And domestic violence, violence that occurs within the private sphere, generally between individuals who are related through intimacy or law. It is nearly always a gender-specific crime perpetrated by men against women. And it is used as a strong form of control and oppression. These are some definitions of domestic violence. The fact of the matter is this, that domestic violence is a real phenomenon that we need to talk about, that we need to discuss. Domestic violence makes life for many women and many children a nightmare. There's no doubt about it. And domestic violence makes life impossible for man and his wife to maintain and to live a good life, to live a better life, of course. And domestic violence is an evil phenomenon that unfortunately exists, and undeniably it exists, of course.
At this time we have a short break, and then we'll listen to the continuation of the speech of Sheikh Javed Akbari. You're listening to For a Better Life from IRIB English Radio.
Dear brothers and sisters, addressing believers, the Holy Quran says, "Believers, be dutiful to Allah and bearers of just witness. Do not allow your hatred for other people to turn you away from justice. Deal justly, it is nearer to piety. Have fear of Allah. Allah is aware of what you do." So this is one verse of the Holy Quran, which is obviously about doing justice, about being just, about not allowing hatred from other people to turn you away from justice. And what is actually important is to be just and to practice justice. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُونُوا قَوَّامِينَ لِلَّهِ شُهَدَاءً بِالْقِسْطِ وَلَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ عَلَىٰ أَنْ لَا تَعْدِلُوا اِعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ إِنَّ اللَّهَ خَبِيرٌ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. So deal justly. اِعْدِلُوا. It is nearer to piety. هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ. Have fear of Allah. إِنَّ اللَّهَ خَبِيرٌ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. And of course, God is fully aware of what we do and of what you do. So, dear brothers and sisters, obviously, domestic violence is an undeniable phenomenon, and it does exist. But there are verses in the Holy Quran. We need to discuss that specific verse, which is in the Holy Quran and which has been interpreted or maybe translated by different translators differently. We need to use a correct translation of that verse. Of course, we will discuss this in the following episode to come to a conclusion. First of all, we need to understand the definition of domestic violence. I gave you three definitions of violence. And there is a verse in the Holy Quran which says, of course, we need to be just, we need to fear Allah, and we need to deal justly. And of course, the hatred from other people should not make us turn away from justice.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Obviously, everyone should adhere to moral values, understand his or her responsibility, fulfill it, and make sure that he or she acts within the framework of his or her religious and moral obligation and moral duty. The religion of Islam has set our rights and our obligations. Every individual, whether man or woman, has his or her rights and obligations. If everyone does and fulfills his duties and his responsibilities, of course, complications, problems, and quarrels are less likely to arise. If we fail to do what we are supposed to do, that is when quarrels begin to emerge. And that's when feud, struggle, and of course, internal violence and domestic violence begins to emerge. And in order for us to live a prosperous life, in order for us to live a better life, we need to change our behavior, we need to follow the teachings of the Holy Quran, and we need to follow the teachings of the infallibles, the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, and the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam. Inshallah, I will follow this discussion in the next episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for this program. Inshallah, we'll listen to other episode of this program for a better life. Same time, same channel. Fi amanillah.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need. So all I need. All I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.